This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time. My guest is the author Paul Lucas, speaking with us today about the invention and history of wine. Your new book, Paul, tracks the uses of wine across the distance of the last 8,000 years. You say that what changes over the centuries is not so much the chemistry of the product, but the meanings assigned to the drinking of it. Maybe you can begin by telling us where in the world wine first made its appearance, and why was it thought to be a gift from the gods?
Well, as best we know, Lewis, wine originated in what would now be called Transcaucasia, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, northern Iran, eastern Turkey, that region of the world between the Caspian and Black Seas, roughly 8,000 years ago. Now, the archaeological evidence for that is fairly recent. It's about 20, 25 years old. So it may well be that people in the next decades find that wine is older still in some other place. But as best we know now, that's where it started. And it started from the very beginning, as best we can tell. It was revered by people as something unworldly, as something godly, as something sacred. And I think the reason for that is that, unlike other beverages, wine is a wholly natural product. If you had a bunch of grapes and they fall to the ground and they're ripe, wine will start to be produced inherently. Unlike beer, in which grain has to be soaked and harvested, which is almost as old as wine. But beer clearly needs human agency to be produced. Wine doesn't. And if the ancient cultures did not think of nature as we do, as something that unfolds according to principles. They thought of nature as coming directly from God or the gods, so that this was somehow associated with the divine from the very beginnings of any records we have about who drank wine and why they did it.
So the reasons to drink it are sacred in order to imbibe the spirit.
As best we can tell, the reasons that many people in ancient worlds drank wine was to commune with divinity. Obviously, there were very different cultures. Ancient Egypt is different than ancient Babylonia, is different from ancient Assyria, etc. But wine in all these cultures is pretty much reserved for the nobility, who frequently were figured as being themselves descendants of gods, and the priests. It was not a common beverage. It only starts to become a common beverage in ancient Greece, and when it starts to become a common beverage, part of the polis there, it retains its sacred status. It's simply that sacred status applies to more than the nobility. It applies to the common man as well, which seems really sort of coincidentally nice for the world that invents democracy.
And I read somewhere that the word symposium comes from the Greek meaning drinking together.
A symposium was and then Rome inherits the same thing and calls it a convivium. A symposium or a convivium were occasions for people to get together and to drink and discuss. We tend to associate it with great philosophical discussions because we've read Plato, but the symposiums or conviviums could be sort of everyday gatherings of fellows to discuss current events or discuss a funeral that one had attended or a wedding that one was going to attend. But it was a gathering usually all male of people in which drink played a necessary part because drink brought with it friendship, wit, conviviality, which we've inherited from convivium. So drinking was a necessary part of it. One didn't drink to become inebriated. One drank to have Dionysus or Bacchus make the situation convivial and make the situation happy and encourage good conversation.
By this time in early Greece, we have learned how to cultivate wine. I mean, we're not just finding it in nature. I mean, we've learned how to grow it and how vineyards
Absolutely, and that goes much farther back too. That people were tending vineyards and deliberately making wine, and deliberately storing wine. That goes back, as I say, roughly 8,000 years.
But they're having trouble preserving it or storing it because it turns sour very rapidly.
Absolutely. This is the great problem with wine for the vast majority of its history. It's not until the really early modern, what we would call the modern period, until the 17th, 18th centuries, that this begins to be, in small ways and then eventually in large ways, corrected, that wine turns into vinegar very quickly. It sours, it spoils. And this is a problem because wine, the harvest of grapes, happens only once a year. So if one wants to drink wine through the year, this is a significant problem that one's eventually going to be drinking vinegar. So what the ancients did was add all kinds of things to their wines, some of them as preservatives, because they learned that adding marble dust, for example, which is high in acid — they didn't know anything about the acid, but they knew from experience that adding marble dust to wine would prolong its life a little bit. But even more than as preservatives, they added flavorings to wine to disguise its otherwise acrid, acidic, vinegary taste. And this persisted well into the Middle Ages, of people adding things to wine to make it taste unlike itself, to make it taste palatable. And they added everything imaginable, from spices to lead to pine resin. They added all kinds of things to wine, because wine by itself, which was really the drink of the poor, was not very good.
And you and I, drinking a very ancient wine today, we probably wouldn't like the taste of it.
As best I can tell, if we somehow were magically transported to ancient Alexandria and we were drinking wine with the Pharaoh, we would want to spit it out.
What happens, all right, but it spreads over the Mediterranean world and Roman Empire. I mean, vineyards come into cultivation in southern France, in Germany, in the boot of Italy. It spreads over Europe.
Yes, it spreads over Europe, and it spreads over Europe as a drink for everybody in all social classes. It's not simply the drink anymore of the wealthy and the privileged and the blessed by God. It's the drink of everybody. And a major reason why it's a drink of everybody is that it is safe to drink. It may not taste very good, especially the wine that the poor drink, but it is safe. And living in villages and urban centers, oftentimes, not always — the Romans certainly had aqueducts which brought fresh water to major cities, but often in villages and other places, water wasn't very safe to drink. Water brought with it dysentery and disease. So wine, frequently cut with water, which would help sanitize the water, was the everyday drink of the masses from Roman times well into the early modern period. There were really no other alternatives.
And during the Middle Ages, it's grown by and cultivated by the clergy. I mean, you find St. Benedict, and you find other religious monasteries producing wine.
Yes, it's cultivated by the Christian clergy throughout the Middle Ages, but not for the reasons that one might expect. One might expect that it's cultivated by the clergy because the bishops and the Holy Fathers and the priests and the monks need it for the sacrament of the Eucharist. But it turns out that they don't really need much wine for the sacrament of the Eucharist, because the drinking of wine in church is reserved only for the priest. The laity don't drink wine. This becomes, in fact, church doctrine, and it's not changed until Vatican II in the 1960s, so that It's not the congregation that drinks wine in church. It's only the priest, and only occasionally. Not at every Mass does the priest drink the wine. so that they don't really need the wine, and they don't need to establish great vineyards in Burgundy or in the Mosel in Germany or anywhere in Western Europe to promote Christianity through the sacrament. They instead need it to promote Christianity as the social and cultural force that will bring people together. So that for the church in the Middle Ages, wine becomes a vehicle of social bonding. Not so much a religious article in and of itself. The wine on the altar still is sacred, much as it was for the ancients. But the wine outside the church or off the altar, which is what the church fathers are cultivating all the time, those wines are a form of bringing people together in social circumstances, not a form of religious worship.
So it's both, it's a food store source because it has calories, it's also an escape into intoxication from lives in the Middle Ages likely to be nasty, brutish, and short.
Absolutely. Very nasty for many people in the Middle Ages. It's fashionable these days to say that the Middle Ages were not as difficult as many of us were taught. But I think they were still pretty difficult for thousands and thousands of people, and wine was a vehicle of escape.
Let us go now to what you call the modern period. I mean, take us into the 17th, 18th century when wine, as we now know it, begins to show itself.
A number of things happen that are significant for the evolution or transformation of wine into something that we would recognize today. The first is that starting in the late Renaissance, wine starts to be challenged by other drinks. It essentially had reigned supreme until then. Even in beer-producing countries, Scandinavian countries, Northern Europe, England, wine was the more desirable commodity when one could, in those places one had to import it, but it was the more desirable commodity because beer was regarded as something lower class and something that inevitably spoiled, whereas the wine that was sweetened with spices and honey and all sorts of other things, even though it wouldn't taste like wine as we think of it, didn't spoil in the same way.
So that is Sir John Falstaff's delight in sack.
Sack came from southern Spain. It's sort of the forerunner of what we think of as sherry. It wasn't fortified as sherry is, but it's the forefronter, and he delighted in and drank it all the time, and much preferred it to drinking beer on Shakespeare's stage.
Okay, now.
So in around Falstaff, Shakespeare's time, wine begins to have challengers. The first challenger is commercial beer, because the discovery is made that if one uses hops in brewing, and this was a German discovery in the Middle Ages, the beer will last much longer. So for the first time, there develops a commercial trade in beer. Even more important, distillation comes to Europe. Distillation comes to Europe, paradoxically enough, from the non-drinking Muslim East, but it comes to Europe to make perfumes and medicines, but people soon discover one can distill and make drink. So the first things that are distilled are grapes and wines to make brandies, but before long people are distilling everything from potatoes to making vodka and wheat and barley to making whiskey and juniper berries and all kinds of other things to make gin, and distilled spirits become a real challenger to wine, and they have one great advantage over wine, namely they never spoil. If you open the bottle of gin, it tastes the same 6 months from now as it tastes today. And then the third challenger are what I call the imperial drinks, coffee, tea, and chocolate, which come from the colonies of the European powers and spark great enthusiasm, especially in the 17th and 18th centuries, as non-intoxicating drinks which have a different effect on people. They have a chemical effect too, because of course they all have caffeine, not alcohol, but they represent another challenge. So wine has to respond to these challenges. And wine responds to the challenges through science and technology. In terms of technology, the biggest advancements are the invention of sturdy glass bottles and secure cork stoppers, which will extend the life of wine immeasurably. As soon as one is able to really securely seal a bottle of wine, it's not going to turn into vinegar in the same way that it has done for thousands and thousands of years. In terms of the science of it, this is the 17th and 18th centuries, and extending into the 19th, are when scientists really turn their attention to fermentation, to trying to figure out what happens during fermentation. It's when they discover that it is sugar in the fruit that gets converted into alcohol. It takes them a long time to figure out exactly how this happens and why it happens, but that knowledge enables vintners to have greater control over their craft. And by the time we get to the mid-19th century, the good wines of the world, the wines that are regarded as something aesthetically valuable, have stylistic similarities to what we think of as wine today.
And are many of those wines centered in France, in Bordeaux?
They're in France, Bordeaux and Burgundy especially. Bordeaux is a much bigger producing area, so more in Bordeaux, but certainly Burgundy also, certainly in Champagne. The vogue for Champagne starts in the mid-18th century and then grows and grows and grows in the 19th. They're also in Germany, the Riesling wines from Germany. They become part of northern Italy, Piedmont and Tuscany. They become part of Spain. And before too long, by the time you're in the second half of the 19th century, they're happening. People are making or trying to make so-called fine wines in South America, in North America, in Australia. So there becomes wine made on this style, these kind of stylistic models, beginning to happen all over the world.
Tell us, Paul, where we are now. I mean, we now making wine on every continent, and how many varieties, how many different flavors, and how big is the market worldwide today for wine?
The market is huge for wine. We live in the, if you and your listeners are wine drinkers and wine lovers, we are all lucky to be living in the best time in the history of the world to be drinking wine, because there is more variety, there is more choice than ever before, extending up and down the price scale. You can spend thousands of dollars on a bottle of wine, and you can spend $7 on a bottle of wine. And the odds are pretty good these days that the wine is going to be chemically sound, the wine's going to be stable, the wine's going to taste basically good. And as you noted, there is wine made in every continent except Antarctica today. The quality keeps getting better and better when viewed historically. And the variety of choices available to consumers keeps growing. People new to wine are often intimidated by it, because you go into a wine shop and there are literally thousands of choices, but which doesn't happen with most consumer products. I mean, there are not thousands of choices of orange juice or thousands of choices of blue jeans, but there are thousands upon thousands of choices of wine. But that diversity of choice is in many ways wine's great strength, that different wines from different places made with different grapes taste, well, different. And the joy of wine is that, unlike other alcoholic beverages, it presents this wide variety of flavors and aromas that the most expert aficionado can never exhaust.
Is it still a signifier of class status, as it was among the ancient Greeks and among the nobles of the Middle Ages?
I think it's becoming less and less so. this is as much anecdotal as anything else. I mean, one can tell some things by sales figures, but wine has become, at least in this country, part of middle class life. It's not really part of life for the poor as much in this country as it traditionally was in wine producing countries. In, as you say, the ancient world or the medieval world. But wine has become a pretty stable part of bourgeois middle-class life in America, a country which only a generation or two ago had little, if any, interest in wine, and middle-class people would look at wine with disdain. So I think wine is losing some of its veneer of exclusivity and sophistication in favor of a kind of democratization of it, which it seems to me is all to the good.
So the golden age of wine is not in the past, but in the present.
The golden age of wine is 2013.
Thank you, Paul Lukas, for speaking with us today about inventing wine. I'm Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News.